the expression from the music inspired me so much to take risks, and it inspired damn near the whole rap game.
Hello again, I'm Adam Ons. You may know me as the host of The Opus, and now I'm bringing my own show, The Spark Parade, to the Consequence Podcast Network. I speak with artists and creatives about the cultural artifacts that spark their personal interest and creativity, whether it's music, books, movies, video games, or any other kind of art.
I've never spoke about it in this amount of detail. I'm suddenly going, oh my God, I'm blowing my own mind here, Christ. It's actually a giant part of my life.
By talking about the things we love, we share and discover insights into our personality and the things that drive us.
It's just magic, really. I mean, frustrating. And it makes some people angry, but I don't think anyone's ever done anything like it.
I speak with people like Connor Roberts, Phoenix's Thomas Mars, Chris Gethard, Helen Hong, Adrian Young, and more, so their sparks of inspiration can start a fire in you.
I'm grateful for those who continue to put our history and who we are as a people in the forefront and make you see it.
Find the Spark Parade wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the Consequence of Sound Feed. As the weather keeps heating up, all I can think about is a good dance festival. And nothing would make me more excited than rocking out to a good ska song. So while we wait, why don't we take a moment to listen to In Defense of Ska. On In Defense of Ska, our host Aaron Carnes and Adam Davis flip the narrative on a genre of music that really deserves to be celebrated. They chat with people inside and outside of the ska scene, tell stories, show the pervasiveness of this culture, and defend it till their last dying breath. On the debut episode on the Consequence Podcast Network, In Defense of Ska takes Peanut from 311 back to his ska and reggae roots, looking back at Bob Marley, Fishbone, Real Big Fish, Voodoo Glow Skulls, The Urge, and No Doubt. They also talk about Jordan Morris's graphic novel Bubble, and talk about some of the artists that are inspiring Peanut today. If you like what you hear, check out the link in the show notes and follow In Defense of Ska wherever you get your podcasts, so that you can stay up to date with every single episode as soon as it's released. So now, please enjoy In Defense of Ska, episode 157, Peanut of 311.
Welcome to In Defense of Ska. This is our first episode on the Consequence Podcast Network. We aim to push back on the mainstream's negative perception of the music. Ska deserves the respect genres like punk, hip-hop, and hardcore find among their listeners. Our host is a renowned music journalist and author of the book In Defense of Ska, Aaron Carnes.
Today we bring on 311's bassist Peanut to talk about the group's place in ska. 311 formed in 1988 in Omaha, Nebraska. They put out some indie releases and moved to Los Angeles in the early 90s. The band scored their first number one single in 1996 with the song Down from their third album. The song hit at the same time as ska was climbing the charts, and the group were often spoken in the same breath as the 90s third wave ska boom happening in the mainstream at the moment. And now, joining me is my co-host, veteran ska musician Adam Davis of Omnigon and Link 80.
311 isn't really ska. Why do you think they get lumped in with ska bands?
The mainstream didn't really know a lot about ska, so a lot of bands got lumped in, like Smash Mouth, Sugar Ray, and the Swing Revival. In the case of 311, they definitely had more ska elements than most.
Yeah. When I first heard 311 in high school, they were playing with both ska bands like Skank and Pickle and new metal bands like Korn.
That makes sense. 311 were influenced by a lot of genres.
Yeah, that was true of many bands of that era.
So I spent a good chunk of time watching your bass solos on YouTube.
Oh, shit. Did you get some elements of ska in my bass solos?
Well, the thing that struck me was that they're like different. Like, do you compose bass solos like every tour? How does that work?
I mean, there's themes that I play that I want people to recognize, and there's songs that I'll play that I want people to sing along to. But other than that, it's all improv.
Oh, is it? Okay.
Yeah, I'm not really. I'm just trying to not do the same thing. I'm trying to play patterns that come to me in the moment, really, you know, and I need to make them more melodic. That's always kind of my point, like to show off the melodic side of the instrument, as a lot of times we're just making the drum sound better in a lot of cases. But yeah, I think that's why they let me do it at all, is because there is some kind of exploration that goes on, and I'll stumble upon melodies that I'm not really even planning. So Yeah, it's fun to do. And you know, thanks for going down that rabbit hole. It makes me nervous still. It's like the only thing playing live that makes me nervous at all. And I guess that's a good thing, because if I wasn't nervous, then you know, I guess I don't care. So I still care. But it's a lot of about the bass solos, because you know, just making something up on the fly is a little nerve wracking.
Yeah, it is interesting, because like you're saying, there are parts where it's extremely melodic, and then you'll like do something very rhythmic, like it's like slapping, and it's like very much about the rhythm that you're doing. And it seems like you kind of switch back and forth between these styles of like really emphasizing melody and then rhythm when you're doing your solos.
Yeah, that's what I'm aiming for. It's super fun. It's sometimes it takes a little to get to where I want to go, and it's cool that the band and the audience allow me to do that. And then sometimes I'm in a rush because I'm feeling the pressure, and I'll just kind of crush everything together. And, you know, that's never going to be the best version of it, but it's still going to be a lot of fun. And my basses sound really good by themselves. So that's something I like to kind of show off too, is, you know, it's not a, you know, $200 made in wherever bass. It's a hand built German piece of art. So, so I'm, you know, I have a lot of fun doing just that, just to even just play pure notes from the bass guitar without any kind of interference is rare in almost any show. That gives me confidence to explore whatever, you know, good or bad idea I'm having at the moment.
You started with music on the violin, right?
I did. I started playing violin at 7 and really enjoyed it. Just, you know, it's like that team thing. I kind of found my tribe in the orchestra as a kid, just having fun kind of doing the same thing, not doing the exact same thing as everybody else, but coming together in a similar way and creating something that you couldn't do on your own. That blew me away. And that, you know, I didn't have that kind of an understanding of it, but that's why I stuck with it, is because I wasn't the only one doing it. I was doing it, you know, with a team.
And then, so what led you to the bass? Cause I think the bass was a few years later, right?
Right. I started playing bass at 11. I got my first bass for Christmas, and I had to take guitar lessons for like 6 weeks because there weren't any like beginner guitar bass lessons. So that was kind of weird and disorienting, and definitely didn't steer me away from the bass. I was like, this puny little thing ain't gonna stop me. I want to do what, you know, Steve Harris is doing, and I want to do what Cliff Burton is doing and Metallica. And then, you know, I've got Bass Heroes, brand new ones, you know, to this day. And it started from those moments. And I like fiddling around with the guitar, but it's always been the bass for me. It's always made sense. I always kind of saw it as there was a hole in the neighborhood. You know, there were drummers and there were guitarists, and everyone thought they could sing, you know, everyone who wanted to, and everyone can. It's the instrument you carry around with yourself. So being a bass player made a lot of sense, as I saw that there was a need for that, even as a youngster. I was like, oh, you know, shit, let's do that. You know, as I speak to myself in plurals.
Well, the bass is an interesting contribution to the songs. It's not necessarily right in your face, but it really adds something that's important to the song. And I think it seems like people who are bass players are really drawn to that aspect of it.
Yeah, hopefully. I mean, I was kind of inundated with the pop side of MTV and seeing bass players like bored out of their minds, you know, just like, oh God, I got to do, 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 beep, 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 beep. I got to do this again. Like, I'm like, man, I ain't going to do that. You know, you're going to influence me in a way that I'm going to curve around that kind of boring aspect of the instrument. And really try my best to shine a light on how cool it really is, and how fun it really is to play. You know, the way Chad and Nick and Tim and SA and all of us write in the band is really bass centric. So everyone comes up with cool ideas, and it's forever interesting to have new batches of songs to work with and hear what ideas they have going on with melody and harmony and rhythm and all these things, and you know what they want to get out of the song from the bass, and the relationship with everything else is just endlessly fascinating to me. Even 33 years working with the same people, you know, it's fun. It's a great experiment because they care about the instrument and what it adds to the songs.
Yeah, I mean 311. I mean, there's so many components to what's in the songs, but definitely reggae and hip hop are two of those components amongst a bunch of other things. But those are styles of music where the bass plays a very central role.
Yeah, right. I'll accent different corners of the rhythm, and it'll be reggae. You know, even if it's in a like a rock context, I think we kind of pulled that off. Maybe even more like dance hall in Come Original, which is distorted and chunky guitars with like a dance hall beat, mm-hmm. and then a slap bass part that is wrapped over. It's just we were drunk with inspiration and influences and the good side of MTV, and like we were talking about off camera, or microphone in this case, is having an older sibling feeding us kick-ass music when we were growing up and we were impressionable, and how that weighs a heavy in the minds of younger siblings. I love that. And that's a fascinating thing for me too. I really wouldn't have played any instrument if my brother hadn't picked up the saxophone. He came home with this brass piece of art that it just is in this awesome case and is all furry and smelled like the music room, which is good and bad. And it just he started playing Star Wars music. He's playing the Imperial March at home, and I'm like, this is blowing my mind, right? Like, I've got to do this. It really turned into that. And I got to know as much as I can. And I'd love to be able to sit down and make noises that people can, relate to or not, for the rest of my life. And it was really, I remember being in his room and being like, oh my gosh, like music, it was just being front and center to someone performing for you in that household setting, when I was super young. It's just, it's still the same thing that throws me upstairs for a couple hours a day on a good day, but at least an hour a day, playing YouTube videos and playing whatever song I want to, I've been going through a huge Family Man phase recently. The bass player from the Wailers, if you don't know, possibly the greatest ska band ever. I mean, I'm just going to say that. It seems on theme.
Sure.
Certainly wrote one of the blueprints for the archetype of the whole sound. So, and he's still doing it. He's still around, and we shared a stage with them, in one form or another of the Wailers, and we did a song together. Me and Family Man were playing bass right next to each other, and it was one of those things that I will never, ever, ever forget. And he's such a unicorn of a player. He's so melodic and he's so rhythmic, and no one can really give his lines justice. You either do or you either are or you aren't him, and you either can in that way or can't play his lines the right way, because he has so much restraint and so much creativity, outside of that restraint and inside of that restraint. It's hard to believe.
Which song did you guys play together?
Did we do Iron Lion Zion? I think I can't. I honestly, I can't remember. I was in just such a daze. I was just watching him the whole time, and he was all over the neck. I'm like, I'm like, what are you doing, dude? And he's just like, wow. It was like a horn solo of a bass line that was totally every note was right. And I bet he never played it before like that or after like that. You know, that's what I kind of look for in inspiration. It's like that gospel pianist thing where it seems like a good gospel pianist can play any song any way they want to in any style with it. You know, it could be single notes and it'll make you cry, or it'll be 10,000 notes, you know, all at once and it'll make you cry. It's that musical understanding that goes beyond mine that you know, is you know, it's this inspiration that I'm forever referring to.
So in 2018, there was the Back to the Beach Festival, and 311 were one of the two main headliners.
Oh, yeah.
Every other band on that bill is just straight up ska band, you know, mostly from the 90s. Some of them are current. I'm curious, very fascinated about your perspective, because I feel like you weren't a ska band per se. You had elements of it, but you kind of were adjacent in the scenes at that time. Even remember news reports about the ska thing happening, and you guys and like Sugar Ray and some of these other bands would get mentioned too, alongside, you know, Mighty Mighty Boss Tones and, you know, Really Big Fish and stuff.
So great. Yeah, we luck out since we play the ambiguous musical hybrid game, you know, pretty well. We get introduced into playgrounds that, you know, maybe we should or shouldn't. Like, you know, we've kind of earned the right in whatever way, whoever's promoting the show and the audience, you know, adheres to that as well. But yeah, it's just, I don't know, there's open doors for us because we're good entertainers, and our music is eclectic in that way that we can play almost in front of anybody. I've seen some audiences that weren't so happy about us playing, but for the most part, we're welcomed in almost every aspect, you know, of live music. And, you know, we don't play outside of our field that much, but yeah, you know, we can wear that hat. We can wear lots and lots of hats, and most of them still fit.
What's the most like outside of your comfort zone show that you play? Like, who have you played with where it was like, what are we doing? There has to be one.
I mean, opening up for Jay-Z was super, super hard in 2001. Yeah. We were doing the Sprite Liquid Mix tour with him and Talib Kweli and NERD and a couple other just incredible bands, and very much, you know, we, for the most part, you know, 50-50 shows were like normal, but the shows that weren't those normal kind of shows were, you know, it was a tough situation. We were being told to get the F off the stage in not so many words. And that's hard to take as an entertainer, you know, like, like we've got time left, you know, like we're not done. And I'd love to give you what you want, since that's, you know, we're serving the public in this way, and you paid a ticket for it, and I want to give you what you want. But one of the things we can't just do is just leave because you don't like our songs. But yeah, the Chicago show was particularly hostile, and I was like palms up, like we're almost done. It's like we have 5 more minutes, everybody, and then we'll get the fuck off the stage for you. But you know, and we've been, like I said, like totally spoiled with those open arms usually. So that little bit of hardship is more hilarious than not, you know. And that's just psychological, but like physically difficult. There was a Warped Tour show down in Australia where we were playing with the Mighty Mighty Boss Tones and Blink, and just, that was an amazing tour. We should do that again. It's raining in Melbourne, and it was just a mud fest. I mean, the audience was belligerent, and they were throwing like huge amounts of mud on stage, and I got hit right in the chest. And it was great too. You know, you got to have some adventures on the road, or you're not doing it right.
Yeah.
What was the Back to the Beach show specifically? What was that show like? Seemed like the crowd was pretty receptive.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, SoCal can be, it can be non-responsive. It can be a total love fest. And I saw Back to the Beach as like a victory lap. Mm-hmm. You know, that was very much appreciated by the audience, and it was an incredible setting, right on the water. That was great. I think Feldy's got a lot of talent, and putting on festivals is something that not that many people can pull off. And I think Back to the Beach was a success, and hopefully it'll continue to be so.
Did you tweak your set for that specific audience at all? Were you thinking, how are we going to make this a little more ska?
Right. Yeah. Not in any kind of not specific way. I mean, we really only have I'll Be Here a While that kind of is, for me, in the tempo of ska. Mm-hmm. And I'm always pushing that song because it's novel in that way, as it's got a definite skank to it that is perfect, you know, the best part of the genre, gets people moving in a cool way, even if it's, you know, melancholic or whatsoever. But I think we made it kind of, we simplified it, I think, if anything, since we're kind of considering that more like a K-rock show, as that's our big rock station down here.
So back in the 90s, though, I mean, you played with a lot of these bands. I'm just kind of like, just looking through, like, I know you toured with Fishbone, Goldfinger.
Yep.
Voodoo Gold Skulls, I think.
Hell yes, Voodoo Gold Skulls. God, what a band. Real big.
Real Big Fish.
Yeah.
You did some stuff with No Doubt, I believe.
Oh, we did. Yeah, we did lots with No Doubt.
Now, as you guys were coming up, before you guys sort of were a big band, you guys were kind of coming up at the same time as a lot of these bands, right?
Yes. Yeah, that's how that's how I saw shows in the 90s was, and we were so busy. And there was a few years that were 100 plus shows for us, and we were playing anything we could. So yeah, I mean, and Fishbone was a huge influence for us as the kind of SoCal hybrid music scene. They were the center of our universe for a little bit, you know, them and Janes and the Chili Peppers. Mm-hmm. And, you know, like 24/7 Spies to a lesser degree. And I think they were from a different part of the world anyway, but you know, bands like that were blowing our minds, and to have the opportunity to play with them was just nuts, you know? And then you got the Reverend Horton Heat too, you know, doing like rockabilly next to these bands too. And you're like, so what's the audience capable of, you know, how big is this influence, this window of influence that we're opening as wide as we can? You know, in the 90s, like, what's that going to do to music for the rest of, you know, our collective lives? It was a magic time. It really was. And No Doubt was absolutely on fire. Those early 2000 mid 90s shows that we played together is unreal. Like, it's like a well-oiled machine that was also kind of chaotic, but there was that, you know, the little tiny little bit of danger in there, and just so much talent on that stage. It's hard to believe. Sucks they're not making music.
And didn't they open for you as you guys were both sort of?
Yeah, they opened up for us on like our second amphitheater tour show, like, you know, whatever, whole tour, where Incubus was opening up. It was like Incubus and Sugar Ray were opening up in 97, and I think in 98 we did a month with No Doubt. Mm. And then they opened up for what's Gavin's band's name? Oh, Bush. Sorry.
Yeah.
That was really the thing that got them over the top, was probably blowing them off stage every night while they were on their ascent as well. And 311 and Bush are still around.
Yeah.
I wish No Doubt was still in that group, because, you know, like I said, I really looked up to their work ethic, and their showmanship was just off the chart.
In Defense of Ska will return in a moment.
What was your exposure to this music? I know you guys come from Omaha, and pretty early on you moved to Southern California. Were you aware of this music before that, or were you starting to discover it after coming to LA?
I played my first show with 311 5 days after my 16th birthday, and we were playing Bob Marley songs here and there, mostly because Nick wanted to. Mm-hmm. And that was a big eye opener for me. I mean, I knew Past the Dutchie and, you know, whatever, like, whatever Jimmy Cliff song, you know, Tear Jerker, just, you know, but I wasn't soaking myself in reggae, and I quickly was, because the bass lines were so interesting, and I had to learn the music, and I realized how different it was approach wise. So it wasn't, you know, it wasn't metal, it wasn't rock, it wasn't funk, it was a whole nother beast, and my job was really important to be authentic. And I take that really seriously, because I don't know, music's the best thing. Music's number one, you know, family and music are the tie, and oxygen probably somewhere in there too. But yeah, I learned real quickly, and I had a lot of fun learning it. I mean, Nick taught me Lively Up Yourself, and that quickly got into our set and was super fun to play, especially with like a ripping loud distorted guitar solo in it. You know, it's like, what's going on? Like, I don't know. It was new information for me. And I mean, that's the only way you learn is when it's new information. So, you know, reggae and ska and rocksteady and dance hall later on is all always so fresh. There's a freshness to it that I don't know, that rock and roll sometimes has and sometimes doesn't have, you know.
What about this sort of high energy ska stuff, like you said, Fishbone was really a critical band. Was there a point where you started discovering like these American like post two-tone ska bands that were mixing ska and like all these other elements?
I mean, I remember listening to early Boss Tone tapes, and just, I mean, speaking of Element of Danger, I mean, it would be like, it was intimidating to think about going to a show, you know, like what, you know, it's going to pop off. There's going to be huge flanneled men going just absolutely crazy. Like this Boston shaped person is going to be this close to me, you know, and I'm nervous, and I'm in the audience, right? It's just, it seemed like a incredible drunken mess that, you know, you'd think twice about dipping your toes into. And that's, you know, this, if you can do that and get people to show up, and you got it made. What an incredible band.
I found an old interview, I think it was in the 90s, where you had said that Nick had a support your local ska band sticker on his guitar case.
Yeah, totally. Way back. Right. For sure. Yeah. Nick was all over the place. Nick would listen to everything. I mean, I didn't know people really liked Elvis Costello that much. I knew that, you know, they had to have, but I didn't really know anybody. And he was that guy. He was also the Clash guy. And we didn't, in my circle, we weren't listening to that. We were listening to the Smiths and the Cure and Bauhaus and, you know, later on Nine Inch Nails, of course. And it's on the dark side of things. So that freshness and that kind of positive reinforcement, you know, mostly, that was eye-opening for me too. That was new information for me too. And it's something that I think lends itself to our, in 311, our general longevity is people enjoy hearing what we're saying, because, you know, we're solving problems, we're getting out of bed without complaining much or publicly. And you know, that lends itself to the music too. Even if the lyrics are dark, if the music is bouncing and bubbly, you know, there's that motivation in it, and you can relate to the dark side of the story. I think that's super important. That's why music's number one.
Okay. So you mentioned I'll Be Here for a While, which is definitely, that is like the most ska like song that you have, right?
Yeah, I would say.
Okay. This song was 2001, and it was actually a hit, or it was a Billboard charting song.
Yes, it was a single, got a cool video for it. Yeah, that's why I push it. I'm like, this is bigger than you think, guys. And it goes over really, really well. You know, you want to make new fans. You want to remind them of old songs that they hadn't heard live. And I don't know, it's like a greatest hit song that is just slightly in the periphery of our normal set list. And that's why I like to pepper it in, because, you know, spice.
Sure, yeah. So I was reading that Nick wrote this song like 10 years before you guys ended up recording it.
Yeah, there's probably some very early versions of it. I remember playing it back then too. I remember a friend of ours that passed when I was 17 hearing that song, you know, and that was 93, you know, so he had it at least for probably close to 15 years, I would say. I mean, that's how I remember it. Right or wrong.
Was the early version also ska, or did that come in later?
It was probably more.
And more ska?
Yeah, it was probably faster because we were young and didn't know how to slow things down. So yeah, it was probably even more. Yeah. I like the way it turned out, but I do remember earlier versions being really like kind of rhythmic.
Yeah.
You know, and that being really cool. And we were, you know, we were loose and free back then, and tempos would vary in a cool way as per the audience's general excitement, and that's always fun. I love that. Love it when a band does that. But you know, enough about me. Why aren't we talking about 100 Gecs? right. I mean, it's the elephant, right? It's the elephant.
You posted a photo with the Gecs. So you met the Gecs like sometime this year, right?
Yes. And I was fucking freaking out. I'm such a fan. I'm such a nerd. And you know, it's not like, if it's some older cat, I'm going to give them space. But if it's some young punk, I'm going to be like, hey, you're fucking incredible. And you know, and I'm, you know, I'm Peanut from 311, but I love what you're doing. You know, please and thank you for doing what you do. How, you know, I was like, how the fuck are you doing what you're doing at all? Right? Like, I want to understudy with Dylan for real. And I love their ska, you know, they're dipping their toes in it left and right. I mean, it's for me, like an electronic, authentic version of it. Like, what's the next page? I think those kids really know what they're doing. You know, between Laura and Dylan, just fucking killing it.
Did you talk to them at all about ska?
I don't know if ska specifically came up, but I'm sure he saw the crazy in my eyes that you might hear a tinge of in my voice as I was just wrapped up in the moment. I mean, my 13-year-old son was like, pretty sure that's Dylan from 100 Gecs over there. And I'm like, no fucking, oh my, I'm like, no way. I'm like, it is. I'm like, no way. And then he moved and he got like a drink and went away from the bar and was going to go sit down. And my son Falcon was like, you're going to go talk to him, aren't you? And I go, and I just like slapped my phone down and I walked over there and talked to him. And yeah, I gave him a mouthful for like 5 minutes. And it was really fun. It was really like cathartic because, you know, I mean, I'm being as honest as I can in a really vulnerable way to some person I have no, you know, I didn't really deserve to bother his personal space, but I felt like I did just because we're in the same game and I knew I could, you know, tell him how much I genuinely feel about their music and what they're doing with their influences, ska included. And it's just, I don't know, it's just amazing. I love hearing new crazy musicians absolutely, you know, destroying the playbook. You know, as the Wailers wrote a specific playbook and we're all still listening to it, I think 100 Gex is going to have a huge influence on music and just let people know that, man, you can do almost anything. You know, if you're inspired and you're talented, you know, that definitely helps. And you put in the time, because that's what I hear from them. I hear them like sweating in the studio, making the thousand layer cake that you have to do sometimes, which is absolutely beyond me. I just, you know, I'll put in the 2 million miles on the road, but I can't sit down and make the musical thousand layer cake like you know, people like that, like studio rats can do. I look up to that so much. It's like Stanley Kubrick for me. Mm-hmm. You know, there's the amount of detail in one image or, you know, 5 seconds of music that, you know, just makes me just do the chef's kiss thing or cry a little silent tear in my shame closet. It's just, you know, that's what gets me out of bed is those details and that passion and seeing what people do with their time really, you know, lights me up.
They must have been stoked to meet you too, because I mean, clearly 311's an influence that they pull from.
Yeah, Dylan, it was just Dylan. Laura wasn't there, but Dylan was definitely stoked. He was like, no way. He was like, oh, he's like, you know, I love you guys. And he was talking about seeing a show back in the day when he was 12 or something like that. And it's crazy how much reach we have. And with the longevity and the amount of shows, you know, if you haven't seen one yourself, you know somebody who has. You know, chances are, if you're any kind of a music fan, we've been around that much. And I like that influence. I hope that's one of the things that we leave behind, besides the positive message and, you know, whatever, being eclectic and being able to show all those influences really boldly. I want to show that kind of like, I don't know, like that longevity is important, and putting in the time performing is something that will allow the band to bake over time. And you can't fake patina. Mm-hmm. You know, you can't fake what me and Chad can pull off, you know, after playing together for 30 plus years. It's a real thing, and it's really important.
Well, I'm hoping that we see a 100 Gex 311 collaboration soon.
Oh man, I would so love that.
Are you familiar with Jeff Rosenstock?
I don't believe so.
He used to be in a band called Bomb the Music Industry, but he's been doing solo stuff for the past decade or so.
Cool.
He's a massive 311 fan. He wrote a open letter on change.org in 2014. Saying that his dream is to play the 311 cruise.
Wow. I mean, we're still doing it. This is one of the cool things,
yeah.
You know,
yeah.
And bringing out, you know, like bands like The Urge and Fishbone, that, you know, at some point in their careers, they weren't playing that many shows, and, you know, seeing them still just slay on stage is nuts. It's the best thing ever.
Jeff, they're out there touring. He's got a band. They tour. They headline, you know, medium-sized clubs right now, have a loyal fan base, ska roots.
Cool.
So I'm just putting that out in the universe, out to you. He would love to play the cruise sometime.
Nice.
I literally worked at Jeff Rosenstock's show yesterday at 924 Gilman Street. Wow. And I told them we were interviewing you, and I was like, is there anything you want me to ask Peanut? And they're like, ask him if we can do the cruise.
we must be cruising. That's yeah. Cool. Right on. Yeah. I mean, tell him to get a hold of Corey at 5B Management, shoot your shot.
All right, Jeff.
Yeah, for sure.
Totally.
Okay. So you brought up The Urge. Let's talk about The Urge a bit.
Yeah.
The Urge are from St. Louis. I think they started in like the 80s.
Yes.
Definitely the early version of The Urge was highly ska oriented. I think those influences tempered down a bit through the years, but they didn't ever go away completely.
Yeah, no way. Yeah, for sure.
And when did you guys become friends? I know you guys have toured a lot with The Urge or played a lot with The Urge over the years. When did you guys first connect with them?
I mean, it was really early on. It might not have been 93, but it could have been. but it was certainly 94 when we were supporting grassroots and doing those 100 show years. We did them with them. I mean, those are the chicken and light beer only days, you know, and which are sparkling memories, but pretty fucking difficult, you know, when it was present day. It was squalid and stanky, but man, it was great too. I mean, I met my wife in that period. I met her in 93 when we were sweating in clubs and, you know, in Louisiana. It's just something about having that kind of traveling circus. I mean, between the Urge and the Funk Junkies, I mean, we must have, it feels like we played 1,000 shows together. And I know it's not like that, but it's hundreds or a couple hundred. And just that wildness and the you don't know what's going to happen every night factor definitely made us better performers, because both those bands have such unhinged frontmen, you know, I mean, and coming from like a Fishbone influence, that's a tall order. And it's a lot to, you know, pull off every night. So I don't know. It was just, those are touring brothers of ours that we would, fight, die, and kill for, if I may be so bold.
I know I did like seeing that you guys still play with them, and like, didn't you bring them? Was it this year that you brought them on the cruise?
Yeah, I think it's a couple times they've been on the cruise. And they have a great time. They bring out their families, you know, and they, you know, I don't think they play a ton of shows.
We'll be right back after this.
All right, so I want to go back a little bit. So the first official show that you played as 311, you opened for Fugazi.
Yeah, that was like a lucky phone call.
I need to hear more about this.
Definitely.
Yeah. I had a girlfriend that saw the flyer at the record store that said like Fugazi was looking for bands to open up. And we called and we got a slot better than a local band that had been together for years. I don't know how we were lucky enough to get that slot, you know, Cellophane Ceiling, which is a killer name of a band. They deserved it more than we did, but we got the slot and yeah, it was a great show. It was unreal. Super, super fun. And I was so eat, sleeping and drinking Fugazi at that time that it was just kind of meant to be. It's what it felt like.
What's your favorite Fugazi record?
I mean, I'm a 13 songs repeater guy, you know. Nice. Like I won't choose between the two.
Yeah.
They're the same album for me. It's that those eras just crush into each other in a perfect way. And I love the angst and the tension that they're capable of putting together and the release, you know, that comes from that energy. It's, you know, second to none.
I mean, also from a bass player standpoint, those records, you can't really fuck with them.
No way. I mean, I was talking to the bass player after that show. I was like, that was great. You know, I'm like 16 in Omaha, Nebraska, talking to punk rock legends, you know, and they were like, that show sucked. Basically, I was like, no way. It was like, he was like, we just, you know, didn't feel good. There was like a physical, I think they had some flu going around or, you know, a cold or whatever, but they weren't feeling it in that way, but it was a great show. They were totally wrong. Their perspective means nothing.
So you guys were Fish Hippos. Is that what, and then you on stage, you said, we are now 311.
Right. Yes. We had the unfortunate first name.
How long were you a band as Fish Hippos?
Oh, it was just like in rehearsals, and then it was like on the advertisements, and probably right around that same time, you know, as we announced it during that show, we had made the switch to something more, I don't know, less specific. And that was the whole point of 311 was that it didn't mean anything. It was like the Smiths. It was a container that you could fill in with your own ideas, not someone else's. Nick didn't want to be the crazy boys or the good boys or, you know, anything like that. He wanted it to be indistinct and esoteric and, you know, allow us to make the definition from our content.
How nervous were you playing opening for Fugazi in front of what? Probably like 400 or 500 people, I'm guessing, at like a local hall or something in Omaha?
Yeah, it was 500 people at a place called the Sokol that isn't there anymore, unfortunately. But it was there for a really, really long time. I think they've changed the name and they've upgraded it. So it's still a gig, but it's not the, you know, it's not the place that I saw Danzig in when he was supporting the self-titled album, and he did Mother, and the drum set was like 17 feet off the stage and had purple lights, and you know, I can go back there in a heartbeat. But yeah, I was real nervous opening up for Fugazi. I was ready. I had put in the time. At that point, I must have been playing bass 3 hours a day. I mean, I was missing out on events and social situations. I mean, I skipped homecoming. I mean, I was busy trying to be ready for whatever was going to come next, you know. And even as at a young age, I was pretty focused. You know, my mom had a backup plan for me and was probably hoping for me to come back after a few months of coming out here in California and struggling, but that was not the case. By the time I came back and got my diploma after leaving in February and getting the diploma in like May or June, we had already gotten a record contract. We had put in so much time recording and doing shows in the 2 years after that first show at the Sokol with Fugazi that we were ready to go on the road and record the first album. So those were super fun times, but they were dense. They're dense with doubt and confusion, but also like, you know, dead set on trying to do this one thing.
Yeah, that show. So the Sokol show was June 1990.
Yep, June 10th.
Yeah, June 10th, 1990. So when did you move to California? It was a couple years later?
Yeah, we moved. It was like February 20-something, 1993.
Okay.
Or I mean 92, sorry.
So you're like 18 then by the time you're moving to California?
Yeah, I was 17.
Wow. Yeah, I bet. I can see your mom being worried sick about that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, she actually gave a friend of hers that lived out here like power of attorney. So if, you know, if I was signing a record contract or, you know, whatever, I, you know, got hurt or something, she could take care of me.
I read the story about, I think it was your first tour. You guys were touring around in an RV and you were towing a VW bus.
Very ska. it wasn't our first tour because we had done some van touring before that. And yeah, fire.
Yeah. Can you tell the fire story?
Yeah. We had just fueled up the RV, which was Chad's dad's RV that we were borrowing and abusing in the way that we were touring. We were towing something that was not meant to be towed like that, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah. So we had just gassed up the RV and didn't realize that there was something faulty in the fuel line, or maybe as the fuel line attached to the internal combustion engine, but there was a fire in the back of the RV as we were driving through Missouri. And by the time we figured out that it was a loss, we had to jump. Nick was last, and I wasn't on the RV. I was in our sound guy's Honda in the air conditioning. So I tell this from a disjointed perspective, but Nick was the last one out, and he had long hair, and he had to shave it all off because it like burnt his eyebrows. He had to jump through like a tiny little wall of fire as the flames were overtaking the whole vehicle, and the RV was full of the Volkswagen part of the whole touring mechanism was full of our equipment, and so it was all our gear and $20,000-$30,000 worth of RV that we couldn't afford to buy or repair. So it was really a put up or shut up moment, and we borrowed money and paid it back within 6 months after being kind of put in our place by a higher power or Mother Nature or whatever fate. It was kind of like that. If there was like a, maybe I will be a plumber. This is stressful. I got to the gig with our sound guy Brad, and was like, what the, where they should have been here already. Like we had probably taken our time, or maybe we were going faster than them. But they called ahead and they said that the show was canceled, and I didn't know until a couple hours later that why it was canceled. And we borrowed gear, played a show, I'm pretty sure the next day, at a brewery in Omaha, now defunct, called Sharky's, which was an awesome place, super fun, lots of pool. And then after that, we came to California, and we just, we used the borrowed money to put the pieces back together and put shows on the calendar, and yeah, we've been doing it ever since.
Wow. So you get a record contract within like a 6 months of moving to California?
Yeah, we were sending tapes out before we moved. So it wasn't like, there was immediate interest. I mean, Eddie offered our producer for music and Grassroots was on our doorstep the moment we landed. Here in California, when we got to our Van Nuys house, we were in contact with him, and he knew where we were landing, and he was very interested in fostering our young talent, and definitely had everything to do with us getting signed. And there was a friend of ours named Bo, who worked at a jazz label called GRP back in the day. And she connected the dots for us. So it was a coming together of friends and professional angels that got us to that accelerated kind of interest so early on. And Capricorn, our label, was like, yeah, you're going to play shows. They're like, you know, maybe you'll get on the radio. They're like, we don't really care. We like your band. You put on a great show. Why don't you guys do that? And we'll help you guys do that. We're going to put you a couple $100,000 in debt to make an album, but you guys should go, you guys should do shows. And we're like, cool, let's do that. But yeah, it's expensive to start a band up, in those days it was very, very expensive. Sure. And super hard to recoup. We were lucky as hell to do it. And it just made us want to work harder because we weren't going to stop. We're like, okay, well, we're six figures in debt and we make, $500, $1,000 a show. It's like, okay, what, how many shows is that? let's go, we'll die trying.
Yeah. The first single, Do You Write, like you listen to that song and it seems like you guys are all over the place stylistically, which it's a great song. So I'm not like saying it as a negative, but like you can really see how, especially in those early days, you're trying to do a lot and you're taking influence from all over the place.
Yeah. We were having so much fun with the way it felt to throw everything together that, we weren't really even aware of how, schizophrenic or disjointed or unhinged, if you will, might come across, because we knew it was a good song, even with all these kind of stylistic gymnastics going on. That's a good sound. it just made sense to us. And we really did have a lot of support from the label as far as making our own bed, they weren't really telling us what single. We just kind of agreed on it. We were like, you know, let's do this, let's do that. But it was never really a struggle to pick out singles, which we're notoriously bad at.
So when I was going down the rabbit hole of watching your bass solos, I also found a video that was from your, I guess, high school talent show where you're covering Red Hot Chili Peppers' Taste the Pain. Was that just like a group of friends?
Well, that, I mean, if we were 311, that was honestly, that was like the first performance of any band called 311. We were called the 311 Band. That's how it was written down on the call sheet, but we were 311. And yeah, we played, there was a couple of different drummers that were happening. And then I ran into Chad and hitched my wagon to him professionally and emotionally.
Yeah.
And we played as 311 with Nick in the audience at like a high school event. But you know, those weren't shows. You know, they were performances, but they weren't shows. That's why the Fugazi thing's the first one.
Yeah, yeah.
I would say, but yeah, it's amazing that footage exists, and you know, I'm thankful that got recorded.
You're definitely going hard in that video too.
Oh yeah, I was not doing anything except for coming in. I mean, it's a few years later we're, you know, doing the stage, the Ed Sullivan stage with David Letterman, you know, playing down, you know, and you can see that footage, of course, as well. And I wanted to have that same energy, you know, a few hundred shows into the career and really tasting the I don't know, the opening of the doors, because it wasn't success yet for us. It was still a ton of hard work. But the doors were opening for us, and we were getting these opportunities to play in front of, you know, a million people at once on TV and stuff like that. So the coming hard young and pushing that through, like the first wave of people seeing us, was really the point, you know, like as a 15-year-old and then later as a 20-year-old, I wanted to be young and crazy and still knowing what to do.
Yeah. Another thing I read is that you cut your dreadlocks and when you broke up with your girlfriend and you gave them to her. Is that a true story?
Yeah, I don't think so. I think it was more just like I needed things to change, so I got rid of, you know, my long hair for the first time, and just kind of let it go. Yeah, I don't think there was an exchange, although that's very romantic. Although, and gross at the same time, equal parts. I've got a couple dreads, honestly, from the second wave of me growing dreads. Like what you see in Come Original was a second batch, and I've got like the mega dread from that batch somewhere in my house, which also is romantic and gross.
Do you keep it in a plastic bag?
It's in a box somewhere, like dried. Okay. So yeah. Keep some mold down.
Yeah, yeah. I also had white boy dreads for a period of time, and I have one in a drawer still.
Yeah, you do.
That's it. Yeah. We're linked. Yeah, people talk about, you know, they're like, hey, Peanut, you know, bring back the dreads, and you know, beyond my wife being like, hell no.
Yeah.
I'm like, yeah, you can't do that in this day and age. And that's okay. I don't pine for the ability to be culturally insensitive or whatever. Sure. Like, you know, we're lucky enough to be able to play the music we can play without being called out in those kind of ways.
Yeah.
Because hopefully we do it in a respectful way. You know, it's definitely how we're coming off as fans, grabbing all these styles from all over the world. But yeah, taking on a look is a whole nother thing. You don't want to, you know, other people's culture isn't your costume. And now we know better.
And also, I mean, I don't know about you, but mine did not smell great.
Yeah. I didn't know that mine didn't smell great, but I'm hearing people say that recently.
Yeah, from your wife?
Well, from bandmates and friends. We got roasted
in Omaha at an event called the Facing the Floor thing for the Omaha Press Club, and we got roasted by some of our friends, and that was one of the things that came up was that I was a smelly dread.
Oh, what a bummer.
It's okay. It was better than some of the other things that got said.
Ah, nice.
I want to ask about your appearance on Eric Andre's show during the Investigate 311 bit.
What a good bit.
That was, I don't know how I had heard of him, but when I knew that he was interested in us participating in his mayhem, that was something we were definitely going to do. Like I don't really pull that card all that often, but like going to the pyramids in Mexico City was one thing that I was like, we're doing this. And then the Eric Andre show was also one of the things like, hey, I don't know what's going to happen, but we got to do this. This is important. So, yeah, I remember walking into the studio, which was right around the corner from the Hive where we rehearse and write and whatever. He's right. I mean, we could have walked to it. So it was literally that close. We walked through a room, like an empty room, probably, 10 by 10, 15 by 15, proper studio room. You could do anything with it. But it was full of drywall, right? It was a mountain of drywall. And the crew was kind of standing by it, and they started giggling when they saw us react to it. Because it was like a car-sized amount of broken drywall. And I'm like, what is going on here? And tell me more. And this is going to be great. Yeah, so, I mean, Eric's a bass player, so he took it easy on me. And is a hell of a brilliant, wonderful person. And I don't know anyone who balances out that I know what I'm doing and I'm totally crazy thing. I don't think anybody does it better than him. It's incredible.
The way it looks though, I mean, maybe because it was done professionally, it looks like you guys are really taking a beating.
Oh, it was very real.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, Nick was being hit. You know, Nick was being hit with a blindfold on. I mean, he got hit right in the middle, which is uncomfortable for anyone, but especially men. And like Tim was getting shocked, right? There was like an electrode like on his nipple that was like shocking him. And it was a lot. It was more than we had bargained for. And I don't know, that's good TV. That's how it's done.
Someone, I can't remember who it was. Someone got like waterboarded, I think.
Yeah, I think Nick was being waterboarded and being hit. Nick took it the worst. I think Eric's got something against singers.
Yeah, apparently.
Which I totally understand. I get it. Yeah, he was trying to like assault me, but it didn't really make the cut. Like he was trying to chase around and, you know, like get in my pants. And I was like fighting them off, and I guess it didn't play well, but yeah, that was what it was supposed to happen, and yeah, it didn't make the cut. But yeah, those are memories I'll never forget. I love seeing, and there's a Tyler the Creator moment on the Eric Andre show before we were filmed in the show, where they talk about Investigating 311. They all get up and do some kind of groovy dance.
Has Investigate 311 been a thing that's kind of followed you around, or people like kind of joke about that with you?
Yeah, a little bit. You know, you'll see that in like chats and stuff like that. If I go live on Instagram, every once in a while there'll be some wise smartass put in Investigate 311, and you know, we'll all laugh because we know where that's coming from. And you know, I don't know, it's just great.
So a friend of mine, former guest of this show, Jordan Morris, who's a TV writer, podcaster, he wrote a graphic novel called Bubble. Are you familiar with Bubble?
I'm not familiar with Bubble.
Because he has a cameo appearance by you in it.
Nice. No way.
Yeah, yeah. So
yeah.
Send it to me.
Yeah, yeah. The character is having a, takes drugs and hallucinates, and you appear to them and provide sage advice.
Story checks out.
That's awesome. That sounds like Nick and Essay's appearance in the like Animals show on HBO, where where there's like a, you know, like a lonely teenager's talking to his 311 poster, and then Nick and Essay like start talking back. They're like, hey, it, you know, it's like, it's Nick from 311. It's so funny. Such a, like a meta fourth wall kind of situation. Like, I'm like, oh yeah, this is why, you know, this is why we stick around. This is why we keep doing what we do. I mean, between 311 Day, Victory Lap and the cruises and stuff like that, those TV appearances are just, you know, gold for us. It really, really is. It's the best. It, you know, we're looking at ourselves in the mirror. We're the universe understanding itself in those little moments. It means the world to us.
So your name, you kind of mentioned the name was kind of a, had no specific meaning. That's part of what you liked it. But everyone I know, they have three numbers that they bring up whenever possible. And those numbers are 420, 69, and 311.
And if you take 69 away from 420, you get 311.
Yeah, I know. Yes. Mind blown.
Yes. It was meant to be sort of thing.
I know.
And you know, John Oliver talked about it on his show too. He's like, the most important three-digit number besides the Beatles of rap rock in 311, he totally said this, is your how you get a checking account. It's your whatever.
PIN number?
No, it's not your PIN number. It's how you get credit. It's your credit score. Excuse me, as I fumble through thoughts. Yeah, he said the second most important three-digit number besides your credit score is the Beatles of rap rock and 311. And I'm watching this and I'm like, oh my God. Because I'm a fan already. I love almost anything English. So it's easy to like John Oliver forever. I want to shake that hand. Because that's good exposure. That's crazy good exposure.
Thank you for listening to In Defense of Ska. To support the show, sign up for our Patreon. Intro and outro music by Slow Gherkin from the EP Lives. Additional music by Dan P. and the Bricks. Please rate and review the podcast and tell a friend. Follow at In Defense of Ska on social media. The book In Defense of Ska by Aaron Carnes is available from Clash Books. Order it online. Chris Reeves of SPI is our editor. This is your co-host, Adam Davis of Omnigon, leaving you by saying ska now more than ever. All right, starting off season 4 with a bang.
Yeah.
Do you ever think that we would have a Peanut from 311 on the podcast?
I had been texting, or not texting, I'd been tweeting at him for like 8 months to get him on the show. And you know what? It worked.
Sometimes that pays off.
Yeah.
So we talked to Peanut a lot more behind the curtain.
We did. Can you believe that?
You can head over and sign up for our Patreon and hear the rest of the conversation over there.
There's never enough Peanut. And that's why it's worth the $5 to sign up to Patreon to get all of that Peanut.
You might have a Peanut allergy, but you won't be allergic to this Peanut.
No. We got another amazing episode next week. Yeah.
What do we have next week, Aaron?
It's a full-on Craig of the Creek episode. We're going to discuss the ska music of Craig of the Creek with the one and only Jeff Rosenstock and the show creator, Ben Levine.
My kids love Craig of the Creek. This is going to be a good one.